Over the past few weeks, there has been something that has been growing on me with greater and greater conviction. And to be honest, I've shared some of these thoughts in St. Elizabeth and in Kingston. I'd like to also share them here. Because I think that what we will look at this morning is something that is very important. Very important. Something we need to understand properly. And in fact, it's something that we have discussed many times and that we have probably emphasized a lot, but not recently. And because of a failure to emphasize this, I think some things are happening that really need to be changed. And I'm going back to these ideas and I'd like to share them again. And I hope that all of us will listen carefully to what is said this morning. Not only listen carefully, but think about it. And see how we can implement these principles in our lives. This morning I want to talk about foundation principles. Foundation principles. In Revelation 18 is one of the foundation texts, I suppose, not just of our group, but maybe of Adventists. And in Revelation 18, we see God's people called out of Babylon. Let us read very quickly. In fact, I'll read and you can follow with me. But in verse 4 of Revelation 18, it says, "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues." What are God's people being asked to come out of? Out of? Babylon. Out of Babylon. If you read from verse 1, it says, the angel comes down and he says, Babylon the great is fallen. And he says, come out of her, my people. God's people are called to come out of Babylon. And everybody in Christendom understands that we are to come out of Babylon. The problem we have is that everybody has a different understanding of what Babylon is. The Catholics will tell you Babylon is this. The Jehovah's Witnesses will say Babylon is Christendom. Seventh-day Adventists will say Babylon are the other churches with the Roman Catholic Church at the head. Rastas will say police is Babylon. Some people will say New York City is Babylon. And I guess maybe if we ask inside here, you might have varying shades of some of these beliefs. But the problem we have is really defining Babylon. Some time ago, the Seventh-day Adventist Church did not believe in the doctrine of the Trinity. But in 1980, the Adventist Church officially at General Conference voted and accepted the doctrine of the Trinity. Why am I saying this? Because I want to make the point that sometimes people use doctrine to identify Babylon. And if I ask you what are the doctrines of Babylon, you would say, well, infant baptism, Sunday worship, the Trinity, and we'd identify a few things. But I'm going to suggest to you that sometimes doctrines may change. If you say doctrines identify Babylon, what happens if Babylon changes her doctrines? Then is she no longer Babylon? If you use doctrines as the main criterion, you might have a little difficulty. I believe that in identifying these biblical entities, Babylon, Zion, what we need to look at is foundation principles. Because doctrine changes. Even behavior changes. But you know what doesn't change? Principles. The underlying principles. If you can identify the foundation principles of Babylon, then you can know anywhere I find these principles, I have encountered Babylon. And with that in mind, I'd like us to just very quickly revise some of those foundation principles of Babylon. Because I think it's important that we understand. Because if we don't understand what these are, we might find ourselves very much involved in Babylon while thinking that we are safe. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 10, where we see the beginning of Babylon. Genesis chapter 10. It says in verse 8, "And Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was what? Babel." Now, Nimrod was the son of Cush. Cush was the son of Ham. And Ham was the son of who? Noah. So Nimrod was about 3 or 4 generations from the flood. There was Ham, then there was Cush, then there was Nimrod, actually the third. Noah, Ham, Cush, Nimrod. Ham actually went into the ark when he was a big man. So Cush was born right after the flood. And then his son, the next generation, was Nimrod. Now the Bible says of Nimrod that the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. And right away that tells you that Nimrod could not have been a good man. Why do I say this? Because Babel means confusion, and Babel was the beginning, the center of apostasy that developed on the world after the flood. So when the Bible says Nimrod became a mighty hunter before the Lord, that's a strange term. He became a mighty hunter before the Lord. You can interpret that in two ways. It can either mean he was a mighty hunter in the sight of the Lord, or it can mean he became a mighty hunter in opposition to God. What do you think it means? In opposition to God. In fact, in the book The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop, he goes into some history to show you that this is the real meaning of the phrase. Nimrod became a mighty hunter instead of the Lord. And this suggests something. From the days of the flood, and immediately during and after the flood, Noah and his sons, where do you think they would have looked in every crisis? To God. God had just saved them from this flood, and they would have, it was fresh in their mind that everybody in the world had been destroyed, but God had saved them. Every crisis that came up, these people remembered that there's only one way of salvation. They looked to God as their protection, their protector. He was their mighty hunter, if you want to put it that way. Because you see, out of the flood there came all these animals. And I guess the wild beasts began to multiply on the earth. And in those days when humanity was few, then people needed protection from these wild animals as they began to multiply. Because animals, multiply far faster than human beings. Whenever people had any need, any problems, they would look to God. But the Bible says now that Nimrod became such a mighty hunter that people began to use his name as a proverb. They began to say, man, this man is good, this man is strong enough. Just like Nimrod, the mighty hunter instead of God. He came to be recognized as the defender of the people. People began to look to Nimrod as their defense instead of to God. You see a principle developing where man began to look once more to humanity. To a human being. And when this happens, always people stop looking to God. And it says that the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. It doesn't take a theologian to remember that out of Babel came the kingdom of Babylon. Now let's go to chapter 11 and read a little bit more about this development of Nimrod's kingdom and its principles. Chapter 11, same Genesis. It says, beginning from verse 1, and I'll read down to verse 8. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to, let us make brick, and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth. And they left off to build the city. Now this is the history of the Tower of Babel. And this was the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom. Nimrod founded his kingdom at Babel. But apparently after this confusion of languages, the kingdom of Nimrod remained there and grew and became Babylon. Now, I want us to look at the reasons why these people decided to build this tower. Because right here in these reasons, we find the foundation principles of Babylon. Let us observe them very carefully. Let's go back to verse 4. And find out what these people were after. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. Notice the first thing they wanted to do. They wanted to build a tower to reach where? Now, I ask myself many questions about this because I'm wondering, why would people want to do this? Now, it can be literal or it can be figurative, reaching heaven. But I think that's what the people said. They said, let's build a tower whose top may reach to heaven. They wanted to build a vast tower, a huge tower whose top actually reached as high as possible. Maybe like the Empire State Building, maybe like the Twin Towers, I'm not sure, maybe even higher. But their aim was to do what? To reach heaven. And I wonder, do they mean to reach heaven in a spiritual sense or in a physical sense? Why would people want to build such a tower? I think the idea behind it was somehow related to salvation. Whether it was physical salvation or spiritual salvation, it was a way of saving themselves. It has been suggested that one of the reasons was they said, if a flood comes again, we're going to be safe. In other words, it would have been physical salvation, man's way of protecting himself, and it seems right in keeping with Nimrod's name as a mighty hunter, what? Instead of or before the Lord. Somebody who built a way of safety and security where you don't have to depend on God. Men solve their problems. It seemed to be something like that. That was the original intent behind building the city. The second principle, they said, and let us make us a name. What does that mean? When you say, boy, this man has a name. What do you mean? Famous, a reputation. When people hear this name, they are filled with admiration and awe. To have a name in this world is something that people covet. Some people go to great extent, to great lengths, to see to it that they have a name, a reputation that people look on them and hear the name. In fact, if a man dies and does not leave a name behind, even some children, even today they consider it some kind of tragedy. Nobody to carry on your name. People think a great deal of the name. And they want the name to be exalted and admired and respected. These people wanted to make a name for themselves on this earth. And they thought, you know what? If we get together and create some great edifice, we're going to make a name that the world will respect. Now it's interesting that when you go back into history and you search from Genesis 1 to Genesis 10 here, you will find that until this time, the first record we have of people building cities is the story of Nimrod here. I think it says that Cain went and built a city. But you know, when the Bible talks about cities before the time of the flood, what happened was that a man and his wife went and built a little house. And maybe his family developed around him and they would call it a city. But it wasn't really a city. Just a little family group. But after the flood, When cities began to be built, Nimrod was the first one who built a city. And the Bible says the beginning of his what? Kingdom. He established a kingdom. And he gathered people together. I don't know how he enticed them. Maybe it was with promises of security and safety. But he put them together. And when you have a city, one of the first things that you begin to do, you have to have some kind of what? Government. You have to have some kind of government, you have to have some kind of control, you have to have some kind of system in place, not only to keep people in order, to supply people, to protect people. And this is how Nimrod came to be regarded as a mighty hunter instead of the Lord, because he became the person who was in charge of these cities. So they wanted to make a name and they wanted to find a way of salvation outside of God. And the third reason it says, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Their intention was that they should stay together and have a great organization where everybody could work together and be very happy and live happily ever after. You know, man has a little adage that says there is strength in what? Numbers. Strength in numbers. That's a human adage. And if you look with physical eyes, it seems to be true. You know, one of the things that Ellen White said, She said that one of the agencies that will bring a time of trouble to this earth, that such as never was. I don't know if anybody remembers what it is. One of the agencies that will bring a time of trouble to this earth, such as never was. The trade unions, Brother Webb. The trade unions. Now that seems a strange thing, because in the world today, if you talk against trade unions, people think you are stupid, because they say trade unions protect the worker. Because you know what a trade union is, right? A group of people who work together in the same kind of trade. They band together and they say, we are being ill-treated by our bosses. Let us work together and we'll be stronger. And we can tell them we need to have more pay. We need to have better working conditions. And if they don't like our demands, then we are going to strike. We are going to make them. We are going to force them to treat us better. And it seems like trade unions are good things. But I'll tell you this. Babylon probably was one of the first unions of humanity, some kind of trade union. And one of the things they wanted to do was to avoid being scattered upon the face of the earth. Unity in strength. Whenever people unite together, yes, they have a bigger voice. But you know something that always happens when that takes place? Always you find that the minds of a few people or of a single person control the minds of the masses. It always happens. Whenever you have human organizations, of necessity, you need to have some kind of controlling factor. Because everybody has different minds, different ideas. You need to have some kind of controlling factor. And always they have found that the simplest way is to put one man or a small group of people in charge of the body. And when that happens, you're able to bring control. But you know what happens afterwards? The people become mindless followers of a few people. If you look at what is happening, those of you who keep in touch with sports, in West Indies cricket right now, I mean, that really is not important in the ultimate scheme of things. But you know, the West Indies Players Association, that union, ever since they formed that, all kinds of problems in West Indies cricket. And that is not the only problem, but it's one of the major problems, West Indies Players Association. And you know, things like this happen whenever there are unions. Control of many by the individual or by the few. And Nimrod was the first one who mastered this art. He set up himself to be king over the people. And he became so successful that the system of religion that Nimrod started at Babel is in every single nation upon the earth today. It was in all ancient religions. Sometimes the names change a little bit. But Nimrod and Tammuz, who became the sun god, and his wife Semiramis, who became the moon god, that system is in Babylonian religion, Egyptian religion, Medo-Persian religion, Greek religion, Roman religion, and today it is carried on in Roman Catholic religion. From the days of Nimrod coming down across the ages, his system became so successful that it has continued today without break. Well, you have to think that if these are the principles of Babylon, the foundation principles, and I have written down three of them here. One, it's a human way to salvation. Two, it's the desire to become great and famous, to make a name, to impress people by our appearance. And thirdly, it's the desire for centralization, for congregating together and avoid being separated. And that doesn't sound like a bad thing, but I'm going to show you why it's so bad. Well, you would imagine that if this is true and these are the principles of Babylon, the principles of Zion would have to be something different, wouldn't they? Let me ask you, if the foundation of Babylon was the kingdom of Nimrod, where would you say Zion began? In the history of the Old Testament, where would you say it had its beginning? Huh? Abraham, I would say Abraham. Abraham. After the flood, two distinct groups began to develop. Because everybody came out with Noah, they were basically worshippers of Jehovah, although Ham had an evil seed in him. But then you had the two systems developing. You had Babylon, and round about the same time, or shortly after, you had God calling his people, and he called a man named Abraham. And interestingly enough, where did Abraham come from? Out of Babylon. He was the first one that was called out of Babylon. And our calling out of Babylon today is an echo of that first call of Abraham to come out of Babylon. He came from Ur of the Chaldees. And then he moved to Haran, and then God called him further. But the principles on which God called Abraham, in those principles we can find the foundation principles of Zion, just like how we can find Babylon's foundation principles in Nimrod's kingdom. And I want us to look at what were the principles of Abraham's call. Look at Genesis chapter 12, a couple of chapters later on. We'll read verses 1 and 2. In fact, we'll read verse 3. Now the Lord had said unto Abraham, get thee out from thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make thee a great nation. The first principle of Zion. Who builds the kingdom? God. Not Nimrod. Not a great hunter instead of God. God himself builds Zion. I will do this. Look at what else God says to Abraham. And I will bless thee, and I will make thy name great. Babylon says, we will build a tower. We will make a name. We will set up ourselves. God says to Abraham, I will do this. I will do this. I will give you a great name. You don't have to aim for this or work for this. And I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. Now as you look at the three principles of Babylon, you look at Zion, you see the exact opposite three principles. God said, first of all, instead of joining with others, what did God tell him to do? Come out. Separate. God separated him from other people instead of joining him with others. That's the first, or that's one of the foundation principles of Zion. A principle of separation. Whereas the principle of Babylon is a principle of what? Confederacy. A principle of joining together. Zion's principle is a principle of separation. The next thing is that the foundation of Zion, the builder of Zion, is always God. Zion has a name. Zion becomes a great nation, but never through the principles of human wisdom. Can we see that? Go a little further, Genesis 15 and verse 1. And we look at some of the promises that God made to Abraham. And we see that these promises are so wonderful, but they are always based on the same foundation principle. After these things came the word of the Lord to Abraham in a vision, saying, fear not, Abraham, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. What principle of Babylon was opposed to this? Nimrod was the great hunter. But God says, I am what? I am your shield. Zion is built upon the principle that people depend upon God. Babylon is built on the principle that people look to human beings and depend upon human beings. This man is smart. This man is more learned. This man is more intelligent. And we need this man to be our leader or our guide. That is the principle of Babylon. In Zion, people look exclusively to God, and they recognize him as their shield. It's not something that is built by humanity. It is built by God. Genesis 7, verses 1 and 2. It says, and when Abraham was 90 years old and 9, the Lord appeared unto Abraham and said unto him, I am the Almighty God. Walk before me and be thou perfect. And I will make my covenant between me and thee, and will multiply thee exceedingly. Notice that everything that they were after in Babylon, God is promising it to Abraham. They were after becoming a great nation. God says, I will do what? I will multiply you exceedingly. Later on he says, I'll make your seed like what? The stars of the heaven. But what is it based upon? Walk before me and what? Be thou perfect. God's promises to Abraham, God's promises to Zion at the very beginning are based upon our walking with him. I want to establish a principle that you must never forget. Success in God's business, progress in God's business, comes by no other means other than by walking with God. Sometimes we think we need to plan more carefully. Sometimes we think we need to organize better. Sometimes we think we need to motivate more. The only condition, when I look through these scriptures, the only condition that God gives is that Abraham should walk with him and obey him. Later on, God says, you know, I am going to do this and this for Abraham because I know that he will order his household after him. God's promises to Abraham were based on the fact that he knew Abraham would continue to walk with him and to lead others in the same way. And God says, I will use you to bless all nations. What Babylon could not accomplish by force, God promised that he would do for Abraham. Notice something here. Abraham didn't know from one day to the next what God would require of him. Abraham, above all people, lived a very uncertain life. One day he was sitting at home and God says, get up, take your family and start traveling. He didn't know where he was going, did he? But he just got up, and how old was he? 75. And even in those days, that was starting to be an old age. Because when Sarah was 90, and God told her she was going to have a child, she laughed. She says, it has ceased to be with me after the manner of women. She had reached menopause, right? She was a woman well up in age. And Abraham himself, although he had children when he was up 120 odd, but at that time, even he was beginning to doubt whether he could have more children. So at that age, 75, he was a man getting on in years. And God says, get up and go. And he got up and he went. The principle you see of Abraham's life, he was not in a position where he could sit down and plan from one day to the next what he was going to do. He could not make any long-term plans. Why? He didn't know what God was going to tell him to do tomorrow. Where was Abraham's safety? It was in living with God one day at a time. Today I will live with you, and if you tell me to do this tomorrow, I will go with you there tomorrow. And upon this principle, God promised to make him a great nation and give him a name that would not be forgotten. Has God changed these principles? This was the source of Abraham's strength and success. And like I said this morning, and we had a little bit of a controversial Sabbath school, but you know, I notice in several places where it says that others were blessed because of their association with Abraham. That was one of the verses I was going to read, but we read it already. I don't need to go over it. But God says, he remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the overthrow. And Abraham, interestingly, is the only person in the Bible that is called the friend of God. In fact, he's the only person that God says of him, my friend. I mean, he says David was a man after God's own heart. And he says Daniel was a man greatly beloved. But if you read in Isaiah, I think it's 48, and let me give it a verse. It says that Abraham, God refers to Abraham, and he speaks of him as Isaiah 41 and verse 8. He says, Abraham, my friend. And sometimes I forget, and sometimes I drift away from that principle. But every time I remember it, and every time it comes back to my mind, I want to cherish it, because really, this is the only foundation upon which anyone can sensibly and securely stand. It was Abraham's foundation. It was the reason why God did these things for him. It is the foundation of God's people. God must be our friend. And when that is true, we are building on the true foundation of the church that will last forever. When the individuals of God's church have God as their friend and their only security, we are on safe ground. So God called Abraham my friend. Look at Numbers 23 and verse 9 and see what God says of Israel. And even though this prophecy was given by an apostate prophet, it is still true. He was speaking under inspiration. This was Balaam, when Balak called him to curse Israel. And here's what he says. Verse 8. How shall I curse whom God hath not cursed? Or how shall I defy whom God hath not defied? From the top of the rocks I see him, and from the hills I behold him. Lo, the people shall dwell how? Alone, and shall not be reckoned among the nations. That was God's plan for Israel. That is one of the foundation principles of Israel. Israel don't mix.
God's people are not counted among the nations. And in this case, you could say they are not counted among the denominations. They are not counted among the church groups. When you find people who profess to be God's people starting to mingle and to mix with all kinds of religion, all kinds of religious groups, then you know that you have gone into Babylonian principles and you have stepped aside from the principles of Israel. This people, God says, shall not be reckoned among the nations. A principle of separation, not confederacy. And I want you to notice how a little later on God emphasizes. We'll look at that in just a moment. But go to 1 Samuel and let's remind ourselves of something here. 1 Samuel 10. And we have looked at this so many times that we hardly need to go there again. But I just want us to look at the verses again. Look at them. 1 Samuel 10, verses 18 and 19. In fact, from 17. And Samuel called the people together unto the Lord to Mizpeh. And said unto the children of Israel, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt and delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, and out of the hand of all kingdoms and of them that oppressed you. But you have this day rejected your God. What did the people do? What were they doing? They had asked that they should have a king. Now, look how strongly God puts it. You have this day rejected your God, who himself saved you out of all your adversities and your tribulations. And you have said unto him, nay, but set a king over us. Now, you know that this was one of the most terrible times in Israel, because when it happened, God said to Samuel, don't worry yourself. They have not rejected you. They have rejected me. When they ask for a king, what's the difference between asking for a king and before they asked for a king? What was the difference? I mean, was the organizational system in Israel different after they asked for a king? What was so bad about asking for a king? Because you might say, well, you know, God still had the prophet Elijah in the time of the kings. He still had Isaiah and Jeremiah. He still used people to talk to these kings and to talk to the people. What was the difference? For one thing, they looked just like the other nations. But practically, I'm going to tell you there's something that you need to consider. Sometimes the system you set up does not make a lot of practical difference. But you know what it does? It changes your way of thinking. Right now, in this group, suppose we appointed somebody to be our president. Let us just say for argument's sake. Practically speaking, nothing might change. Practically speaking, we might operate the same way. But you know, in the minds of some people, and maybe over a period of 10 years or 20 years, do you know, changes in the way we think would begin to take place. Changes that would affect us down the road. Changes that would affect the way we view ourselves and the way we view our responsibility to God. So, sometimes, it's not so much that there are practical changes. It is what happens in our minds when certain changes take place. That is very important. And when the people said, make us a king, God realized that the people did not recognize. They refused to acknowledge that they were being led. They refused to acknowledge that somebody was taking care of them. They refused to acknowledge that the presence of the Almighty was there. What they wanted to do was something that looked good. They wanted to be like what? Like the nations. They wanted to be like other people. They wanted a name that people could look at them and respect them and say, they are somebody. They wanted a reputation. When God was with them, they were a disorganized people, it looked like. There was no head that you could look to and carry your complaints to apart from praying. And when you pray, you don't see God. You don't hear Him answer. They were not satisfied with dealing with an invisible leader. They wanted something visible that would make them like other people. And with grief in His heart, God agreed to what they asked for. But He told them that it would cause great problems among them. And it did. In fact, I will tell you the truth. If you want to know why Israel was rejected, I believe it was because of the king. Eventually, Israel was totally rejected as a nation, and I think it was because of the king. Because if God had remained their leader, that would never have happened. Israel rejected God's form of organization. Look at what God said to them in Isaiah chapter 8.
One of the outstanding marks that began to develop among them after they rejected God. I want to read here in Isaiah 8. From verse 9. Associate yourselves, O ye people, and ye shall be broken in pieces. And give ye ear, all ye of far countries. Gird yourselves, and you shall be broken in pieces. Gird yourselves, and you shall be broken in pieces. Take counsel together, and it shall come to naught. Speak the word, and it shall not stand. For God is with us. Now listen. For the Lord spake unto me, spake thus to me with a strong hand, and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, say ye not a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say a confederacy. Neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. What is a confederacy? It's a union. What God is saying to Isaiah is, these people are talking about a union. Don't say a union when they are saying a union. And don't be afraid with their fear. He goes on to say in verse 13, sanctify the Lord of hosts, what? Himself. Let him be your fear and let him be your dread. Now what was happening in Israel? The king of Assyria was coming to attack Israel. And they went and they asked help from Pekah, the king of Israel, and Rezin, the king of Syria. They formed a confederacy or an alliance with Rezin and Pekah, with Syria and Israel, to come and defend Judah. And God says to Isaiah, don't join any confederacy with who they join a confederacy with. Don't unite with who they are uniting with. Sanctify who? God. Let him be your fear. Let him be your dread. What he was emphasizing was that Israel's protection is God, not even those who appear to be our close relatives. Because Israel and Judah were brothers. I mean, the northern kingdom made up of the 10 tribes, and the southern kingdom made up of the 2 tribes, or the northern of 2 tribes, the southern of 2, I don't remember exactly where it was. But they were brethren, they were from the same 12 tribes of Israel. But God says, don't join with them because they had gone into apostasy. And to human appearance, it seemed like help from these people would have been good. And isn't that the way we think sometimes? That because other people are also Christians, and because they seem to agree with us in some ways, some kind of alliance and union would be a good thing. God says, I am to be your fear and your dread. I am the one that you are to depend upon. And that's the thing I want to emphasize this afternoon. That the foundation principle of God's church is exclusively trust and dependence in God. While the principle of Babylon is the exact opposite. It has to do with human systems and human organizations. And having said this, I want to get to my main point. Because the question I want to ask is, where can we find these Babylonian principles today? Well, I'm going to tell you the truth. These principles govern the world. But the tragedy is that they not only govern the world. If you look among the nations and the kingdoms of the world, you'll find that that is the way they operate. If you look on the great nations of the world, America, even our little Jamaica here, these principles of human control are what run the country. But if you go further and you look inside the churches, you find the same principles of human control and strict human organization. Now, I don't know if we can understand the principles that I was dealing with. Because the main point I'm trying to make is that God's people, there are many things that we need to do. One of the commissions we have is to preach the gospel to all the world. We have a responsibility for fellowship. We have a responsibility for teaching. But what is the basis and the foundation of all of that? That is the main question I'm asking. What is the foundation of all of this? What is the strength and the foundation of Zion? It is individual relationship with God. It is walk before me and be perfect. It is I am your rock. I am your shield. I am your fear.
where each one of us has this foundation, the church will run right. And if that is not happening, all the planning and the scheming and the organization is but a manifestation of Babylon. That's the point I'm making.
Can both work together, the human organization and the human relationship with God?
No. No. And why do I say no? Because if you build on God, your organization cannot be human.
Well, when I say human, I mean a leader. You have somebody that's at the head, a bishop, a deacon, an elder.
If the principle of Babylon where leadership is concerned is this, okay? And you know, the principle of Zion where leadership is concerned is, you know that the princes of the Gentiles rule over them. And those who are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you. But he that is greatest, let him be your minister and your servant. If that is what we talk about, if a person who is a leader is merely a servant, then that certainly is not leadership as we understand it in the world today. It's the exact opposite. So on that basis, you know, we would have to agree. But just as long as we understand what we are talking about. Because you know, in human organization, it is not this way. Those who are in authority discipline the rest. And keep them in line and in order and make them toe the line. That is human organization. And when things go wrong, we say we have to do it because things have to look good. We can't disgrace our name. We are concerned about our name instead of the principles of God. We are concerned about making things work instead of seeking God and letting Him make things work. And the problem is, like I said, sometimes you appoint a king and it's not because the king is there. It's because your mind changes. You know, this group is what I'm talking about. This group is what I want us to examine and look at. Very quick. Right. Well, I'm going to answer you from the Bible. God sent out Gideon to destroy the Midianites, and he did. And when Gideon went out on this battle, everything was perfectly organized, wasn't it? They started out with 30,000. When he made the call to come and fight the battles of the Lord, 30,000 came. And Gideon listened and God said, there are too many. Tell them anybody who have wife and children, go back home. 20,000 went back home and 10,000 were left. Humanly speaking, we would have said, let us go now. But Gideon listened again and God said, still too many. He said, carry them down to the water and let them drink. And when they went down to the water, One group lapped with their hands like this and the rest went down like dogs and lapped with their tongues. And God said, take this group and leave the rest. And when he was finished, he had 300 out of 30,000. And right now, that's about the time when we would say, well, let us plan another day because this one not going to work, right? But 300 people. And when they went out and God said, okay, now the next thing you're not going to carry a sword with you or a spear. You're not going to carry a bow and arrow. All you're going to have is a lamp and pitchers to cover the lamp. And you know what happened? The entire Midianite army of hundreds of thousands was destroyed with 300 people. Now, the people said, Gideon, Gideon, you have won a great victory. Come and be king over us. You know what Gideon said? I will not be king over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Because Gideon knew how they had won the battle. But these people with their limited minds, they were looking at the agent. And Gideon had more sense than that. He said, I will not rule over you. God will rule over you. He had a little bastard son who he went and made himself king over them. Killed off 70 of his brothers and made himself king. And caused one disturbance in Israel. Eventually a woman dropped a stone in his head and killed him. But I mean, to me, these are the things we need to remember. That sometimes, humanly speaking, we can't think outside of the things that we have been trained to do and the way we have been trained to think. But God says, and is God right? Think about this, and is it right? Suppose I walk with God in perfect surrender. Will He lead me in the way I should go? And if every one of us does that and build on that foundation, will we be led in unity and harmony? Of course we will be. If you say no, then boy, it looks like serving God won't make sense. If we surrender to God and walk each of us individually, that is the foundation of Zion. If we do this, God will make us walk in such unity and harmony that we will make a name. without even trying to make one. But when we refuse to walk in submissiveness and things look bad, we have to find a human way to make things look good. And we start building on Babylonian principles. And when things are not quite right, we tighten the screws. And we establish those principles more firmly. And we neglect Zion's foundations. And we build more and more on the foundations of Babylon. And what I want to do is to warn us, brothers and sisters. Because one thing about Babylonian principles, they look good. They look good to the world. Why do you think the Jews wanted to have a king like the other nations? They look good to the world. The principles of Zion don't seem to make sense. You look like a ragtag army. This sect that went everywhere turning the world upside down. When Paul joined them, they said, Paul, too much learning has made you mad. You're a lunatic. How you can mean to go join something like this? Because to human appearance, it was disorganized. It was hated, it was despised, it was not respectable, it had no influence. And humanly speaking, it just was not the place you could be. And you have heard the story. In Pilgrim's Progress, these two men are talking and one says, one of the faults they found with him was that he did not like to walk with religion in her rags. But when she had on her fine clothes, he would walk with her. But God's church usually is religion in rags, because it says God has chosen the poor of this world, rich in faith, to be the ears of salvation. Zion's principles are different from those of Babylon, and we must remember that. You know, we are very conscious of our image. But who gave us that concern? Babylon is the one that is concerned about making a name. Who gave Zion that concern? All Abraham was concerned about was following God. And God says, I will give you a great name. And if Abraham had set out to get a great name, he could never have been one of God's people. He could never have been the founder of Israel, the father of the faithful. Are we more concerned about the work that we are called to do? Or have we now become people who are concerned about establishing worship centers? You know what concerns me? I go to different places. I'm getting concerned. And I notice that more and more the emphasis is upon the church service. More and more the emphasis is upon the Sabbath church service. That is the reason why we exist as a group. Just for you to come on Sabbath, put on your fine clothes and come and listen to a message and have a little debate in the Sabbath school, and then you don't even bother come back on Sabbath afternoon anymore. You just come and you have a little time, and that is your religion? Is that what we were called unto? Is that what God wants of us? When we started out as a group, 30 of us were in this fellowship from George's Valley Church. We never intended to start a church. We never planned to start a church. We never wanted to start a church, because these are the things we used to preach a lot back in those days. We just decided that we'd come together and study the Bible, right? So we studied on Sabbath. What was our purpose in coming out? We had one goal. You know what we decided? As long as we live, everybody in Jamaica is going to learn the message. And every day and every spare moment that we could get, we were pushing the message as we understood it then. We were pushing it. And everybody in the group, we would go out and we'd distribute the tracts everywhere. Why would we come together on Sabbaths and Monday nights? To talk about the blessings. To motivate each other. To encourage each other. And we would go back again and come back again. And when we came together, you couldn't shut up people. When it was testimony time, you couldn't keep people quiet. When it was prayer time, to be honest, sometimes some people fell asleep on their knees because we prayed till late into the night, because the work was relevant. There's no argument about this person not being prepared for the work. The children went with us to give out tracts. Daniel and Dave were little 6 and 7 year old. They went out, hand out tracts, no problem. Little by little you begin to hear arguments. The children don't know enough. Then you begin to hear arguments like, I'm not debating, but one of the things that I really feel strongly about is some people have said that, well, you know, Sabbath is not the time to give out tracts. And when that became an issue in the group, you know what happened? Almost the tract distribution came to a total end. Because when people are undecided, they end up doing nothing. And the focus became more on keeping the church than on doing the work that we have to do. Where in the Bible do you find that Jesus say, go into all the world and raise up churches? Where do you find that? He says, go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. That is our business. And when you preach the gospel to every creature, if people accept the gospel, there will be fellowship. But the fellowship will be a place to strengthen for the work. The fellowship must not become an end in itself. So that we have problems now with the young people, we have to find a way to entertain them. We still have to start keep AY to entertain the young people. You know why? Because the work is irrelevant to the young people. Because you know what they see? The only thing we exist for is Sabbath worship. You come and you have a big debate about fine points of doctrine. And then you go back home. You come and you listen to a sermon and you go back home. What's the point? When people feed themselves and feed themselves and feed themselves, they only get fatter and fatter. And you become unhealthy after a while. You know, there's a story in Pilgrim's Progress. Pilgrim went to the interpreter's house. And while he was there, the interpreter showed him a vision. And he saw this beautiful castle, wonderful place. And it was Mount Zion. And he saw all the saints standing on the walls, dressed in their beautiful shining garments. And there were a group of people outside who wanted to get inside. And Pilgrim said, why don't they go? The interpreter said, look closely. And when he looked, he saw a band of giants with clubs and huge spears and swords standing in the way to guard the way against anybody who would go in. And there were two men standing there, and one said, why don't you go? And the other one said, oh no, you go first, age before beauty. And the other one said, no, but you were here first. The other one said, no, it's fools rush in. And they were there arguing. And everybody wanted to go, but they were afraid because of these huge men in the way. And Pilgrim said, they're afraid. And the interpreter said, look. And when he looked, he saw a man come, a little rough looking man, come along, and but he had on the shining armor. And he said, write down my name. And they said, he's going to be cut in pieces, he's going to be destroyed. And then he grabbed his sword and he charged into the group of those giants and he started cutting and hacking, and they were chopping and shouting and crying out, and he fought his way through and he went in. And there were cries from the top, come in, eternal glory, thou shalt win. And they were saying, look at that young uncouth fellow, look how he just cut his way in. And got in. And then one said, well, it must be beginner's luck. He didn't even have one class in the use of the sharp two-edged sword. You know, the Bible says that the sword of the Spirit is the word of God. And the other one said, well, what shall we do? You go. The other one said, no, you go first. You were here first. And the other one said, well, the time is not right. We must wait for the lottery. And the other one said, yes, and there's not a sign of a cloud in the sky. But in the meantime, while we wait, let us keep our sword sharp by practice. Let us have a duel, on guard. And they start fighting one another. And when you listen to it, you think, brother, it's an allegory. But I mean, doesn't it fit? When you fail to take the kingdom of heaven by force, when you fail to go to the mission and fight the enemy, you know what you end up doing? Fighting one another, don't you? You start practicing on each other, right? And even in our Sabbath school this morning, you can hear a little bit of it. Practicing on each other, right? And we say, we're not prepared enough to go out there and witness to other people. Rubbish! The day I was converted, I was qualified to witness. The day I was converted, I put my Well, when I bought a Bible that week, I put it under my arm and I went everywhere. I tried to grab people. I tried to find my old friends. And you know the only thing I could say? There is a God and He has saved me. That's all I could say because I didn't know anything else. But you know, I could say it with such conviction that people began to believe. Amen. And when they asked me all kinds of questions and began to debate with me, maybe I couldn't answer and it would send me back to go and study. But I was qualified to witness that very day. And if we were involved in the work to which we have been called, I tell you what, we wouldn't have a problem with our young people. Why do you think people go join Rasta? Right here, down here, is a group of people around Manaville. They call them the Hatabal. Why do you think people go join them? There's a guy went to UTEC from Barnstable, went and joined the Hatabal. You can imagine that? A caste graduate. And we couldn't get somebody like that to join here, maybe. Why? The Hatabals are people who worship the sun, right? And you know them? They dress up in these grass skirts like the Arawaks. And they go around half naked. They only have on these grass skirts. That's the only thing they wear. And sometimes you see one of them, I haven't seen him for a while, but they never take public transportation. I see him sometimes walking Maypen. Sometimes poor as he lives on the highway hill. Built a little Arawak hut on the top of the hill. And if you pass, you can see it up there. A red building. And he has his sword and he has on his grass skirt. And he walks barefoot everywhere. And you see him in the boiling sun sometimes. Why people join something as way out and weird as that? Sun worship. Because the people are convicted. They live what they believe. And people are impressed when you live what you profess. When you listen to, as I say, so many times you listen to Buju Bantan. Splinters. Pliers. Chakademos or whatever they call them. Watch when they interview them on TV and see if they have one sensible word to say. And yet everybody, the youths are running into this nonsense. Why? Because people, especially young people, are impressed with sincerity and conviction. And if we live our religion, I'm going to tell you something. We have no problem with the young people. You don't have to plan no AY for them. You don't have to plan any special program for the young people. Look in the Bible and see if you find in apostolic times one special program for young people. Look in the Bible and see if they had that problem. Because their religion was their life. Because the young people were in danger every moment. They could be killed in a moment. Either they were a part of it or they were not a part of it. But if they were in it, it was life. It was not a theory. It was a living reality. And we need to understand what we have been called unto. We don't have to worry about making numbers, about building the church. When we live our commission, it will attract sincere people. And that is the truth. The problem is that we have begun to look at Babylonian principles and church worship and keep church and the forms of what they call church. Where did that ever come from? And whoever gave us that commission? Jesus says, go into all the world and preach the gospel of every creature. And that is our job. And this fellowship, it is only to strengthen us that we may go out and do it more effectively. And you know, I want to say something very kindly. I have so much to say, but I'm cutting my thing very short because time has run out on me, basically. But, you know, there's one thing I want to say. A lot of people come here nowadays just to bless their baby. And to be honest, I mean, if people come and they would like to dedicate their children, fine. But I am grieved when people begin to look at us as that kind of church. They come once, dedicate their baby, and they don't come back. A lot of people are only looking a little refuge where they can feel that they are respectable. When did we ever become such a thing? A place for people to come and sit down and feel comfortable and be respectable. Nobody should be a part of this fellowship unless they intend to be on the battlefield. If somebody should feel that they should be a part of this fellowship, they should know that they're going into hot water. And those who don't like the hot water should find somewhere safer and more comfortable. Because this was not intended to be a hospital or a refuge for sick people. It was supposed to be an army of soldiers. You know, the last time I said this, I think it was Tracy asked me a question. What about the sick people among us? But right at that moment, we had been studying something that morning, and I had an interesting answer right in my mind. Because in the apostolic church, there were a couple of sick people, you know. Their names were Ananias and Sapphira. You remember? When God's church is hot, you know what happens to sick people? They either get well or they get dead. Right? They don't stay sick day after day, year after year, week after week. Sick, sick. And you have to be continually nursing and catching up people. No! When the church is alive, the sick get healthy or they don't stay there. The reason for our problems is because we are forgetting our mission. And I tell you,
There are many different ways we can work, right? We can hand out tracts, we can visit our neighbors, we can preach, we can put ads in the newspaper, we can go on TV. We have many ways you can go. But you know, when we are involved in the work wholeheartedly, even if our message is not that attractive, people are going to be compelled to sit up and listen. Because it's going to hit them from every side, like when we used to give out the mark of the beast tract. Everywhere when somebody say, I get that already, sometimes a man will pull out his wallet and say, see, I have this for the last so many years, has happened to Brother Bill. Because they were bombarded from every side. This little group can do it. As small as we are, we can do it. And when it happens, when we were more alive, people would come from far to come and sit in on our Bible class. Because, not because we invited people, but because people heard that something was happening. But we have to consider what has been happening. We have settled down. We have settled down. We are becoming more established like the nations. We are becoming concerned about how we appear to other people. Which was never a consideration. Our only consideration is to build on the principles of Zion. Walk with God and do His work, and the rest will take care of itself. Well, like I said, that's where I'm going to end. There are many, many illustrations in the Bible that probably would embellish the point I'm making. There's a song that you probably know which says, my house is full, but my fields are empty. Who will go and work for me today? It seems that my children all want to sit around my table, but no one wants to work in my fields. Do you know the song? Isn't it unfortunate that it seems to be getting true of us? That our concern is more about keeping the church service going. You think church service is going to finish the work? 6 billion people, and we haven't even dealt with Jamaica yet. 6 billion people. It will never be finished by sitting down and debating Sabbath after Sabbath and fattening ourselves. Who is going to reach the rest of the world? That is supposed to be our life. But I'm going to tell you, the less we are involved in it, the less realistic it appears. The less motivated we are. And the more we are encouraged to settle down in a situation that does not disturb or distress us. I used to think that because I'm getting a little older, my zeal is diminishing. My energy is not as high. But I discover I'm lying to myself. I'm fooling myself. That's not true. It is lack of exercise that kills you. Even as you grow older, if you keep on exercising, you keep on being alive. I started some physical exercise again, some weights and some running a few weeks ago, and I'm feeling so good. The pain I used to have in my back is going. It's gone. I used to have a pain in my knee. It's gone. And I realized that even my memory, which I keep complaining about, is a little bit sharper. It's kind of like it's coming back. And I realize that, as they say, you don't wear out, you rust out. You don't wear out, you rust out. You die from rust, not from wearing out. Keep the machine moving, and you will keep alive. And that is true spiritually as well as physically. Don't make any excuse about old age or tired or anything. Just remember, say, the reason why we're going downhill spiritually is because we are not doing anything. Ellen White says, a working church is a living church. One last thing. This little phrase from the book Papal Power, written by Henry T. Hudson. I've used this before. I know Howard has used it. I want to read it again for the final thing this morning. A militant movement. What is the meaning of militant? Yeah, something to do with an army. Militant means to be on the warfare. A movement that is on the warpath loses its vitality. What is vitality?
Life.
A movement that is on the warpath loses its life when loyalty switches inconspicuously, unnoticed, from its ideals to its institutions. A movement that is on the war path loses life because, unnoticed, the loyalty switches from the ideals, the goals, the principles,
and it changes to the institutions. The things that we build become our reason instead of the things that we started out to do. Let us go back to first principles. Let us make sure we're not building on the principles of Babylon, but the principles of Zion. It's the only hope for finishing the work. God said, I will make a name. I will make a great nation. God can do it. But you, I, nor Babylon can't do it. The most we can do is build up our own little corner and make a name in our corner. But God intends to finish the work. So let us make sure we build on His principles. God bless you, brothers and sisters.